Please be seated. Good morning. Before I call our first case today, I want to inform counsel that we are going to try very hard as a court to adhere to the red light when it goes on. Now, for those of you who are watching, the attorneys get a green light when they start, they get a yellow light when they have 5 minutes to go, and they get a red light when they're supposed to stop talking to us about their case. The attorneys pretty much uniformly behave quite well. However, the court uniformly does not behave quite well.
Don't take that as a confession of error on behalf of all of us.
We tend to ask questions after the red light is on, and what that leads to is there have been many times when one side has had the opportunity to talk about his or her case for a considerably longer time than the other side has. So today, if you see me trying to urge my colleagues, if they begin to talk after the red light is on, that their time is up as well as your time is up. The reason for that is we want to be fair to both sides, and we want it to appear to be fair to both sides. So as we begin, I hope you will help me with that endeavor, and I know sometimes it puts counsel in an odd position, so I will try to lead the way and say it's time to conclude the argument. We now are going to call the first case, State versus Parisi, 14 AP 1267 CR. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, my name is Tristan Breedlove and I'm representing Andy Parisi. At issue in this case is the meaning of clear and settled law. What is clear and settled is that the Fourth Amendment requires that police officers have to get a warrant to do a search. That's the default position, the baseline. That rule is subject to only a few narrow and jealously drawn exceptions. If an officer is unsure whether an exception applies, he has to err on the side of the Fourth Amendment. He or she has to get a warrant. The state argues that the officer in this case could have reasonably relied on Bowling to draw blood without a warrant. But Bowling created a bright-line rule specific to drunk driving and testing for alcohol concentration in a specific amount, meaning above the .08 legal threshold. The court in Bowling said, the issue in this case is whether the fact that the percentage of alcohol in a person's bloodstream rapidly diminishes after drinking stops alone constitutes a sufficient exigency to justify a warrantless blood draw under the following circumstances. Number one, the blood draw is taken at the direction of a law enforcement officer from a person lawfully arrested for a drunk driving-related violation or crime. The decision used the word alcohol 34 times and used the word driving 19 times. And all the cases cited in Bowling were about individuals operating well intoxicated. Mr. Parisi's case is completely different. It does not involve alcohol.
Was he arrested?
It's unclear if he was arrested. He was taken to the hospital, and apparently his medical condition was unstable for some time.
Yeah, but there wasn't decisions after Bowling said arrest wasn't important.
That's correct.
It was a footnote somewhere that unhinged arrest.
I don't believe that it matters.
Okay.
In terms of the
but this guy may or may not have been arrested. We don't know.
Yes, and it's not clear from the record if he was arrested. What is clear from the record is that he was at the hospital for some time after he was transported there, after they found him at the scene.
And he wasn't driving.
He was not driving. Alcohol was not involved in this case. This was not a case about testing for substance in a specific amount.
What was he ultimately charged with?
He was ultimately charged with possession of a controlled substance.
In his body or in the house?
He was charged apparently for what was in his body, but because you cannot be charged for just what's in the blood evidence alone, the corroborating evidence was the evidence of heroin found in the apartment.
Why can't he be charged about what's in his body?
Under Griffin, I believe the case is, it says that you can only be charged if there's corroborating evidence of so that you can't just be charged for the blood alcohol, I mean, I'm sorry, the amount of drugs found in your blood. And I can find you. State v. Griffin, 220 West 2nd, 371. Presence of drug in a person's system is circumstantial evidence of prior possession, but there must be sufficient corroborating evidence coupled with that evidence of drugs in the system.
Is that true irrespective of whether there's a search warrant?
Does McNeely change anything for purposes of your analysis? What I hear you saying is Fourth Amendment principles are fundamental. You need a warrant. That was law then. That's law now. McNeely really doesn't change anything.
I think what McNeely does is it illustrates the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court frowns upon per se rules, and McNeely saying dissipation of alcohol is not going to be per se evidence of an exigent circumstance. And so I think that that does relate to this case in that the state has argued in terms of the second argument that there were exigent circumstances that the state would really need evidence of heroin itself or of that first metabolite of heroin. And because you'd have to act so quickly to get those things, the state's actually asking for a per se rule that in any case of suspected heroin use, that the officers be able to take blood without a warrant. And that kind of per se rule is frowned upon as seen in McNeely. So I think McNeely sheds light on it, but it's not a driving case like McNeely was a driving case. And it's not an alcohol case.
Isn't it support you? Because it says exigent circumstances can't be dissipation alone, whatever we're dissipating, right?
Exactly, right. Dissipation alone is not sufficient.
Right. So whether it's alcohol or drugs or I don't know what else to add
That's
in
correct.
There, but dissipation alone is not good enough. You'd have to show additional circumstances in order to have a warrantless search
exactly.
of the body.
Exactly. And in McNeely, the court comes to that conclusion even given the fact that officers may sometimes need to act more quickly because what's relevant in drunk driving cases is going from that illegal level to the legal level. And in this case, it doesn't matter what the amount is because any trace amount of drug evidence in the blood is sufficient to prove possession. So,
you know, I sort of see this as I need you to help me here. I think you're walking a little bit of a tightrope. Either if you think McNeely applies, then why doesn't the good faith exception of of our case law since, because Bowling was the law at the time of this case, right?
That's correct.
So then given the court's decisions discussing McNeely and the good faith exception and how Bowling works in, if you really want to say this is that McNeely helps your case because of the exigent circumstances dissipation idea, then how do you get around Bowling providing under what we've decided last term or the term before? I think it was last term that the good faith exception then works against you on this.
Well, because Bowling is a completely different type of case. Bowling is a driving case and it's an alcohol case and it's about testing for a specific amount of alcohol. So testing.
What was McNeely?
I'm sorry? And McNeely's the same, but
okay.
I think what I was trying to say is that McNeely, I think, supports our position in that it says that per se rules are frowned upon. But whether you analyze this as a McNeely case or not, there still were no exigent circumstances. So the state has argued this is a McNeely case, but there's reasonable reliance under Bowling. If the court disagrees with that and just wants to look at it as a pure exigent circumstance case and not a driving case because it isn't a driving case, then it would just be an analysis of the second argument made in my brief, which is that there are no exigent circumstances. And the reason that there's no exigent circumstances is because the metabolites of drugs remain in the system for several hours or even days, so long that there would be plenty of time to get a warrant, as the facts of this case actually show, because there was a delay in getting the blood draw, and there was still evidence of those metabolites in the system.
Our good faith cases say that the law enforcement officer can rely on Bowling, because Bowling said when you got driving under the influence of alcohol, it's you can take a blood, you can take a warrantless blood test, period, right?
Exactly.
And they could rely on that because it was clear-cut, definitive law in the state of Wisconsin.
Exactly. It was
the fact that it was declared invalid later doesn't affect the law enforcement officer who acted on it, right?
Exactly. So when we look at the court's decision in, say, Reese, saying there was reasonable reliance because the officer was acting in exact same kind of situation, it's a drunk driving case relying on that bright line rule for drunk driving cases.
Here, the officer to rely on Bowling, he has to restate Bowling. He has to state that Bowling covers non-alcohol, non-driving.
Yeah, and I think also would have to assume completely incorrectly somehow that Bowling applies when Bowling is about testing for that specific amount. And I think that's really an important part, is that officers know that in drunk driving cases what's really important is that level. And they also know the same thing is not true in possession cases where any amount is sufficient. And so it would be a big leap for an officer to think, I have to get in there and act quickly when those metabolites are in the system for so long and it's not about the level.
You keep talking about the level because here it doesn't matter what the level is, and because of the nature of the drug, something can be detected in the blood maybe as much as 12 hours later.
Yes, yes, and that's according
depending on what experts you've set.
Right, but that's according even to the state's article, yes. I mean, the metabolites of heroin stay in the system for 12, could be even 24 hours, it depends. The half-life is 100 minutes to 280 minutes, according to the state-cited article. So that means somewhere between 100 and 280 minutes later, half the amount is still in the system, and then if you double that, a fourth, and then if you double that, an eighth. So there's going to be metabolites of heroin in the system for several hours, maybe even up to a day, and the officer in this case testified that it would take approximately 2 hours to get a warrant signed. That would leave plenty of time to still get the evidence that the officer sought in from the blood.
Counselor, if the officer didn't know all that you know about the metabolism of heroin and didn't realize that it was on a different path than alcohol is and that it stayed in your body much longer, would that affect your argument about whether the blood draw was lawful?
Well, it wouldn't in that it's an objective test, so it's a reasonable officer test, and I would assert that it's reasonable for an officer to know that drugs remain in the system and that metabolites remain in the system.
Why?
Well,
why is it reasonable for him to know that?
Because police officers work with repeat offenders. They work with people that are on probation, that are subject to urinalysis, and they know that if someone smokes marijuana on a Monday, they're still going to come back with a bad urine test on a Wednesday or a Thursday. They may also be subject to drug testing themselves and have some sense of that. But I think it's also a question of what's reasonable in terms of what I said before about an officer knowing that there's a difference here in terms of I don't have to jump in there and act so quickly to find out if that rate is going from, you know, 0.08 to 0.07, because any amount is sufficient. And so a reasonable officer would know I'm going to have more time because I can get even just a little percentage and still get the evidence I need. Additionally, in this case, police were called to respond to a possible overdose. So a reasonable officer would know you have a lot of heroin in your system if we're coming for an overdose scene and, you're revived from that. So I think a reasonable officer would have a sense that there would be plenty of time to get a warrant.
Did the officers administer a drug at the scene?
The officer didn't, but the paramedics did. They administered Narcan to override the overdose effect of the heroin.
This defendant was found in a residence with trouble breathing, and there was vomit all over the place. Is that vomit potential evidence or not?
No, I don't believe that it's potential evidence that they would have been able to use the vomit to find out what level of drug he had in his system. I suppose it's possible, but I don't know that that's something that you can do, that you can use the vomit at the scene, that it would illustrate anything for them.
Can't they use his hair?
Yes, and one of the articles that I cited talks about how you can find evidence of heroin use, and I believe it's sweat, hair, oral fluid, blood, and urine. Mm-hmm. And I think it lasts in hair for the longest, but it also lasts in blood for quite some time, as we just discussed, and in urine, I think up to 50 hours was the...
Wouldn't that still be a search, though?
The search of the hair?
Yeah, and the search of the urine?
Sure, certainly. I mean, they would be less intrusive searches, but yes, you could get it from those bodily substances as well. And again, that would leave even more time. If you're talking about 50 hours and the officer testified it takes only 2 hours to get a warrant, again, there would be plenty of time to get in there and get that evidence. And actually, the facts of this case illustrate that in that they still were able to get evidence of morphine multiple hours after first encountering Mr. Parisi, because when he got to the hospital, they tried to draw the blood at one point, and his condition became unstable, and they weren't able to get the blood. So it actually ended up being a delay, and, you know, the metabolites were still there, and there was still no problem with getting that evidence.
So what do you want this court to do?
I want the court to apply the law and say that bowling does not apply because it's a bright-line rule about drunk driving, and this isn't a drunk driving case. This is a case about...
When you say doesn't apply, you...
I mean that there's no good faith reliance on bowling, yes. That there can't be good faith reliance on bowling because this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have only ever said that there can be good faith reliance on a then-valid warrant, a then-valid statute, or on a bright-line rule, and this would be something far beyond that. This would be the officer extrapolating the holding of bowling, which is so clearly about drunk driving, again, using the term alcohol 34 times, the word driving 19 times, only talking about operating well, intoxicated cases, taking that holding and applying it to this totally different factual situation. It would be a great expansion of the good faith reliance exception, one that would be unprecedented by this court. Additionally, as I discussed before, I believe the state's position on needing evidence of heroin or that first metabolite, because that heroin dissipates from the system within 10 to 40 minutes, if that is the rule that this court makes, then that would be a per se rule that any time you suspect heroin, you have to get in there and get the blood without a warrant. So I would say I'm asking you to apply the law, say that bowling doesn't apply, there can't be good faith reliance on bowling, and there's no exigent circumstances. But the state,
well,
I think, is asking for
a new rule. Let's just stay with bowling. Because it's not good faith reliance because there wasn't settled precedent. That's your point, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay. Now, the next point that the state makes is, okay, if we accept that from the defendant, then this was a reasonable mistake of law in interpreting precedent.
Yes, and I would assert
this
that...
This is the Houghton Heinen line of cases, I assume.
That's correct. That's the state's position. But this isn't a Heinen or Houghton case. Those cases were about officers being mistaken about the meaning of statutes when deciding if they had reasonable suspicion for stops. So the court in Hine actually said that the case was a straightforward question of statutory construction, and that that there would only be a reasonable mistake of law if a statute posed a really difficult or very hard question of statutory interpretation, and that such cases would be exceedingly rare. There's no statute at issue in this case, and it wouldn't have. And this is also not a case about reasonable suspicion to make a traffic stop. Hine hasn't been applied to reasonable mistakes of case law. It's only been applied to an officer's reasonable mistake about a statute. And allowing mistakes in an officer's interpretation into complicated areas of case law interpretation would be a dramatic expansion of Hines Holding. Officers don't have the expertise to make those decisions about expanding the law, what the law does or doesn't mean. That's a job best left for the court.
As I remember, I think it's a concurrence in the United States Supreme Court that said, hey, if it's really clear on its face and unambiguous, then you can't let the law enforcement officer off the hook saying it's a reasonable mistake of law. It really has to be a tough in order to say that was a reasonable mistake of law.
That's exactly right. I believe it's Kagan's concurrence says it has to be a really difficult or very hard question of statutory interpretation, and said that such cases would be exceedingly rare. So not only, I think, does that mean that they meant for that case to say, we're not going to say that all reasonable mistakes as to a statute or all mistakes as to a statute are reasonable, but I think it's also an indication that the court had no intention of its holding going to a completely different area of reasonable mistakes as to case law.
Why aren't you arguing Fourth Amendment principles, longstanding? Bullying is a drunk driving case, as is McNeely, so put those in their own compartments. And Griffin was the law at the time, and you can't take someone's blood because it doesn't prove possession, and you need a warrant in order to do that. At most, this would be corroborating evidence. Why aren't you just arguing Griffin? I don't understand your wish to combine drunk driving law with this case. To me, they're pretty different.
And to me, they're different, too. And actually, my first brief in the Court of Appeals didn't argue anything about McNeely. I just argued, look, there's no exigent circumstances. The state didn't meet its burden. And then the response from the state was, this is reasonable reliance on Bowling. And that's where that first came up, is in the response brief from the Court of Appeals. And so then I responded in turn, and then that is the reasoning that the Court of Appeals used.
Well, give me your best argument, then. Give me what you want to argue.
Well, my argument is you're totally right. Drunk driving cases, not on point. Bowling is not on point. And so you should look at this from that purview of the Fourth Amendment says the default position is that you need a warrant to do your search. There wasn't a warrant in this case, and there wasn't an exception to the warrant requirement because there were no exigent circumstances, because those drug metabolites remain in the system for so long that there would have been plenty of time to get a warrant. And because there's no exception, the evidence should be suppressed.
So you agree with Justice Ziegler?
I agree with Justice Ziegler that the two are completely different. Drunk driving cases and someone found with drugs in an apartment, they're different. And bowling, therefore, shouldn't apply, and there shouldn't be good faith
reliance. And so you go to the Fourth Amendment. This is an invasion of the body. You need a warrant unless you can find an exception. One exception is exigent circumstance that the state relies on. Another exception is a reasonable mistake of law. And we already discussed Houghton and Hyen, and now we're talking about exigent circumstance. As I understand the state, they are arguing that, look, the law enforcement officer really didn't know what drugs this person took, right? Could have been alcohol, too.
Well, I know that the circuit court made a finding, well, the officer didn't know exactly what drugs he took. I'm not sure that that is completely true, because the officer testified at the suppression hearing that he's seen Narcan work to reverse the effects of a heroin overdose. So I think that the officer actually did know that heroin was used, but I would assert that it doesn't matter what the combination of drugs was, or if it was heroin or if it was cocaine, because the metabolites of all of those drugs remain in the system for several hours. So it wouldn't have mattered in terms of the question of whether there were exigent circumstances.
Well, did they attempt to get a warrant?
No. No officer ever attempted to get a warrant in this case.
Is there evidence of how long it would take to get a warrant? And this was Oshkosh, I remember it.
The officer testified it would take approximately 2 hours to get a warrant signed. That seems long to me, given that there can be communications through electronic means and telephonic means. But even with 2 hours, there still would have been plenty of time. And I would note, too, that there were 5 or 6 officers at the scene, and none of them tried to get a warrant. Additionally, the officer that was with Mr. Parisi at the hospital was told that Mr. Parisi's condition had become unstable and that there would be some delay in getting the blood evidence. And even with that delay, he didn't take any steps to obtain a warrant while he was sitting at the hospital just waiting. So there were certainly times when an officer could have started that process, and no officer did.
Who has the burden of showing the ability to get a warrant within a reasonable time?
Sorry?
Who has the burden of proof to show that you could get a warrant in a reasonable time here?
I believe it would be on the state, but again, the testimony is what it is in the record, that it took 2 hours. Even if that seems unlikely, that is the testimony. And even if it was 2 hours, again, that there still would have been plenty of time, as was seen in this case.
How much time passed between the time they found him and ultimately took the blood? Do you know?
Yes. So they said that they responded. The call was at 12:38 a.m. They arrived on the scene 5 to 10 minutes later, so that's about 12:45 a.m. They left there at 1:15 to go to the hospital, which I looked up is about 10 minutes from the residence. And the first blood attempt was at 1:55 a.m., but they didn't obtain the blood until 3:10 a.m. So they first encountered him at 12:45 a.m. They didn't get the blood until 3:10 a.m.
So they had 2 hours,
mm-hmm,
or more.
Yeah, and it seems that there would have been more because there was this, ample amount of morphine in the blood. So given the half-life of morphine, there would have been even more time, up to several hours.
Are you familiar with the red light's on? I'm sorry. I withdraw my question.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. One of the first questions that was asked by the Court in this case was whether or not Mr. Parisi was charged with what he had in the blood or what the police found in the house. The answer is plainly, he was charged with what the police found in the house.
Why is that so plain? That's almost a surprise to me.
It is plain because he was charged with possessing heroin, and the only place that heroin was found was in the house. There was no heroin found in Mr. Parisi's blood. When the police actually took a test of his blood, approximately 3 hours after the best estimate we have of when Mr. Parisi actually ingested the heroin, 3 hours later, no heroin in his blood. No clear metabolite of heroin in his blood. Only morphine was found in his blood. So they couldn't have possibly charged him with possessing heroin in his blood because they didn't find any heroin.
Isn't morphine a metabolite of heroin?
I'm sorry?
Isn't morphine a metabolite of heroin?
Yeah, but it's not a specific metabolite. And that is the whole...
It's also a controlled substance, however, correct?
It is a controlled substance. It is. No question about it. But the thing is, and I think this is the whole point of my exigent circumstances argument, it's not just quantity that counts for exigent circumstances. It's also quality. It's not just the quantity of what you're going to find in the blood that counts. It's what you're going to find. And it's the probative value of what you're going to find. McNeely says that in terms of discussing exigent circumstances. It's the probative value of the evidence that counts in determining whether there's an exigency. And the probative value of the evidence that you're going to find in the blood of someone who is suspected of ingesting heroin, the probative value you're going to find within an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours of the ingestion of that substance is entirely different from the probative value of the evidence that you're going to find after 3 hours.
I don't understand that. Explain that. You find after 3 hours that he's got something in his blood which makes you indicate that he could have had heroin. After 12 hours, you find something else that also indicates heroin.
Okay, we have to discuss a little organic chemistry. And, well, I hate organic chemistry.
If I wanted to discuss organic chemistry, I would have been an organic chemist.
Yeah, exactly. Heroin is not a natural substance. Morphine is a natural substance. It's derived from opium poppies. But heroin is not a natural substance. It's a synthetic substance. It's a manufactured substance. And what happens is, to kind of simplify it, when you cook it, when you cook the morphine, you add two additional molecules. These are acetyl molecules. You add them to the basic morphine, and that's when you get heroin. Heroin is diacetyl morphine. Di meaning two acetyl molecules added to the morphine. In human plasma, in blood, this synthetic substance breaks down very quickly. It loses one of those acetyl molecules within 10 to 40 minutes. Then you get what's called monoacetyl morphine, which is the morphine with one of those acetyl molecules. Now, that's still specific for heroin. It is acetylated morphine, and it is really good, really probative evidence of the ingestion of heroin because it's morphine with an acetyl molecule. That's heroin. But after about 1 to 3 hours, this heroin, this acetylated morphine, breaks down even further, and that second acetyl molecule dissipates. And what we have then is simply non-acetyl morphine. Now, the thing
is... Why is that important if it's a controlled substance?
Yeah, it is.
Why is it important?
It's important because we've got this Griffin case.
Because what?
That we have this Griffin case out of the Court of Appeals that says that you cannot convict someone of possessing a controlled substance based solely on what you find in the person's blood. So we can't convict Parisi of possession of morphine based on what we find in his blood. We have to find other evidence. The other evidence that we have is not of morphine possession, it's of heroin possession.
Counsel, if I hear your response correctly, we know he wasn't charged with possession of controlled substance, morphine, and so by that you also know that the state in charging him was not relying on the blood work alone.
That's correct.
In other words, he was charged with possession of controlled substance, heroin, and at most, the metabolites found in the blood sample corroborate.
It was evidence. It is relevant evidence that he possessed the heroin in the house.
But that in and of itself would not show possession of heroin.
No.
What has that got to do with exigent circumstances? And they didn't collect this blood until 3 hours after. And under your scenario, it's gone already.
It was gone.
Well, so they had plenty of time to get a search warrant because they were working on a third metabolization.
Well, they were trying. I assume that they were trying to get the blood as quickly as possible so that they could still find some kind of acetylated morphine in the blood. That's what they were trying to do. Now, they didn't succeed. It was too late. They found the non-acetylated morphine. But the exigency arises from the fact that they wanted to get the acetylated morphine because that is specific for possession of heroin. It is much better corroborating evidence of possession of the morphine in possession of the heroin in the house than it's just morphine in the blood. Morphine in the blood means he could have ingested heroin, he could have ingested morphine, one or the other. So it's far less probative.
Is possession of morphine a crime?
Yes, it is.
What do they care? They haven't charged him yet.
They care because of the Griffin case, which says that you need other evidence. And there was no other evidence of morphine possession. There was evidence of heroin possession. That's why they cared. They had to find, in the blood, evidence of heroin possession.
When did they find the heroin?
They found
in the house.
They found the heroin in a, it was in a bedroom of the house to which Parisi had access.
When did they do that? When they took him to the hospital? When they got another search warrant for the house?
No,
when did they do that?
We don't know precisely when it was done. But it was done very shortly after they took Parisi to the hospital. There were officers who stayed in the house at the time, and they're the ones who discovered the heroin in the bedroom. I assume this is not in the record, but it's just a reasonable assumption that the other residents of the apartment told the police about the heroin in the bedroom.
Mr. Parisi did not live at this residence, is that right?
That's correct. He was just a visitor.
How many people did live at that residence?
It is not terribly clear, but my best guess is four, that there were four other people. There were four people who actually lived there.
Okay. Now, the heroin was found upstairs, is that right?
In a bedroom in the apartment, yeah. Okay.
Was there any testimony that the defendant went upstairs?
No.
How could you establish that the defendant partook of the heroin that was upstairs?
That's why you need the evidence that's in his blood. That's why what's in his blood is so critical. It's to prove he went upstairs, he used the heroin that was up there and was available to anybody in the house.
There is no proof of that. I mean, you alleged here that they charged him with possession of heroin because they found heroin upstairs. But I don't think you've established any linkage here. I mean, the corroborating evidence for me, in part, is the use of Narcan, what other people may have said about his background. But I don't see any proof of a linkage that he ever went upstairs.
No, there is no proof that he ever went upstairs. No direct proof. It's all circumstantial. It's all circumstantial. And what they found in the blood, the fact that they found morphine in the blood, which could have come from heroin, is one of the circumstances that goes into proof. Now,
that his response to Narcan was specific to heroin? Didn't that also matter? That his response to Narcan was also specific?
I believe that Narcan is specific for heroin.
Your answer to Justice Prosser.
Okay, I want to go back one step. We never had a trial in this case. There was a plea. That's all we had was a suppression hearing, and that suppression hearing was very limited. The suppression hearing was very limited to the question of exigent circumstances. There was never any challenge made here to probable cause for this search. So we have a very, very limited record, and I want to really stress that. We have a very limited record in terms of what the police actually knew and when they knew it. I mean, we know that they were there. We know that there were four other people there. We know that the police interviewed those people. We don't know what they learned from the interview, because the focus of this case has always been so narrow on the exigent circumstances issue. So there's a lot we don't know, and it's not because the police didn't know it. It's because because the focus of this case, the focus of the evidentiary hearing in this case was so narrow, none of that was ever put on the record.
Counsel,
there was never any need to put it on the record.
I'd like to change your focus a little bit. Because there was a plea here, we don't know whether the state would have prevailed at trial or not to prove
correct.
The heroin
we don't
upstairs
know.
Was his. Right? That's an issue for a trial, but when he entered a plea, that's really not the issue before us today.
Right.
Here's what bothers me with your argument. Just because evidence is really good and it's better to get it earlier doesn't mean that there is an exception to the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment such that there are exigent circumstances. And to me, you're making a little bit of a leap here, saying, ooh, because it's really good for us to get this earlier rather than later, it's exigent circumstances. That's not how I usually view exigent circumstances. So tell me where you get that from.
I get it from McNeely. I get it from McNeely. I quoted it. I quoted the section of McNeely in my brief, where the U.S. Supreme Court specifically says that the probative value, and they use that term, of the evidence that you're going to find in the blood counts in terms of whether there's an exigency.
Okay, but it's never been the law that just because evidence is really good, you don't need a warrant. That's almost what you're saying, and you're
I'm not saying, I'm not saying that just because evidence is probative, you don't need a warrant. What I'm saying is that because this really good evidence, this really probative evidence, dissipates so quickly, at least in the case of heroin, and public defender brought up some other drugs like marijuana and things like that. This is a whole different animal. I agree. If this was a marijuana case, we'd be done. Because marijuana being a natural substance, cocaine being a natural substance, it doesn't break down. Heroin is not a natural substance. It's a synthetic. And it does break down.
So
that's why you need to get the evidence quickly, and that's why you have exigent circumstances, because you need to get it quickly.
So to be clear, you're basically asking us to revive Bowling in terms of heroin cases substances that are not natural.
No, I'm not at all. I am not asking you. I'm not stupid enough to ask you to do a per se rule. Not after McNeely. I know that. No, it's the I'm arguing the circumstances of this particular case. A, where you do have a suspicion that the person whose blood you want to test used heroin, which does break down very quickly, and two, where you have evidence such as we have in this case that it took the police 2 hours to get a warrant. Now, I don't know why it took the police 2 hours to
probably get it. Because it was before McNeely and it was the middle of the night. Having done a number of these, 2 hours isn't unusual. Having said that, what I really hear you saying is, in heroin cases, there's an exigency because it dissipates so quickly.
That's correct. I am saying that.
Bowling for heroin.
I am saying that. But, there are other factors that enter in. In other cities, in other times, it doesn't take the police 2 hours to get a warrant. It doesn't take the police 2 hours to get a warrant in Madison. It doesn't take the police 2 hours to get a warrant in Milwaukee. You can get a warrant in 15, 20 minutes. You know, on your little computer, in your squad car. And there's your warrant.
How was that again?
She missed the third part
of that. A cop in the squad car can get on his computer and go, and he's got a warrant, you know? So I'm not saying that in every case where a person is suspected of using heroin, you don't need a warrant. I am absolutely not saying that. In fact, in most cases, I would concede that the cops can get a warrant, you know, like within 15, 20 minutes. Is Sirkan in Madison?
Back before McNeely.
I'm sorry?
I mean, things have changed since McNeely. This is before McNeely.
This case was before McNeely,
just
yeah.
Because the officer types a warrant doesn't mean that you've found a judge, the judge has reviewed it, and the judge has signed it in the middle of the night.
That's right. That's why we have the testimony in this case. It's uncontradicted. There was a finding by the trial court, in essence a finding by the trial court, that at the time that the police took the blood in this case, in the city of Oshkosh, it took 2 hours to get a warrant. And that's one of the factors that is important in determining whether there were exigent circumstances in this case. And I am absolutely not saying that those same circumstances would apply in any other case, certainly not every other case. And I am absolutely not saying that any time there is suspected heroin use that you don't need a warrant. I am not saying that. I am limiting my argument very specifically to the facts of this case.
But Counselor, we rarely take a case to make a decision that's only good for riding to Oshkosh on Tuesday, which is what you're arguing to us. You're arguing that we should act like a trial court here and not make a rule of law. That would be contrary to how we operate on this court. You must know that.
I am making, well, I am making an argument to save the conviction in this case. All right? I told you not to take the case. I opposed the petition for review. There is an issue of law that applies, and that is the combination of the good faith exception and the reasonable mistake of law. That's an issue of law that applies in this case. But whether you took the case for this purpose or not, I, as an advocate, I have to make any and all reasonable arguments that are going to sustain my conviction.
I agree with that. I was just surprised to hear
and
you
that's
say
why,
that.
And that's why my exigent circumstances argument appears number two. It's a fallback argument.
But it's your first here. It's the one that you're arguing here. Your first arguments in the brief are the good faith and the reasonable mistake of law.
That's my first argument,
and
yes.
And you think that's what the court should rely on then?
Absolutely.
Not exigent circumstances.
You could rely on either one of them. I think that you should decide the issue of law, that where you have this confluence of these two exceptions to the exclusionary rule.
Good faith and reasonable
mistake of law. Good faith
and
mistake of law that they apply together in this case. Not to justify the seizure, but at least to say that if the seizure wasn't justified, you shouldn't apply the exclusionary rule. But if you don't decide in my favor on that one, I'm saying I've got this fallback argument that wouldn't deserve review in this court on its own merits, but it is a fallback argument which could save the conviction.
I look at page 15 of your brief, and this is where you rely on McNeely. You say, quote, in McNeely, the Supreme Court stated that exigent circumstances exist when, regardless of the exact elimination rate, quote, a significant delay in testing will negatively affect the probative value of the results of a test of the defendant's blood.
And I'm relying on that quite heavily.
I know you are. And you go on to say, no warrant is needed when waiting to obtain one would significantly undermine the efficacy of the search. You know, if you lean on that too heavily, you destroy all of McNeely, because by definition, alcohol dissipates, and by definition, the dissipation affects the probative value of the results. And then you go on in page 16 to say, in this case, waiting 3 hours or more to obtain and execute a warrant would have significantly undermined the efficacy of the search of Parisi's blood and negatively affected the probative value of the results of a test of that blood because a belated search would have found only morphine rather than heroin. It just seems to me you're pulling out of McNeely a concept. I mean, I didn't check you, but I assume your quotes are accurate, although I didn't look at the words before and after, but I assume they are accurate, and that they undercut McNeely. The basic concept of McNeely is you need a search warrant because dissipation alone is not enough.
I don't think they undercut McNeely. Okay. I don't think that simply saying, as McNeely does, and it is a quote, I mean, I don't put things in quotes that are not there. They say it, probative value. Now, all that means is that there may be cases where, under all of the circumstances, which is what McNeely was all about, no bright line rule, under the circumstances, there may be cases where, under all of the circumstances of that particular case, it is necessary to take blood before you can get a warrant to save the probative value of the blood that you take. So it's still an all the circumstances rule, but what I am saying is this. It's not just quantity. It's not just the quantity of the evidence that counts. It's the quality of the evidence. It's how good the evidence is. It's the probative value of the evidence.
You think they had this case in mind?
I'm sorry?
Do you think they had this case in mind when they said that? Because I don't know what the quality of the evidence would be in a drunk driving case. Blood alcohol.
They probably did not have this in mind when they said that. I find nothing in the McNeely opinion that suggests that they had heroin in mind when they made that statement. However, they made it. It's there. It's a statement of law.
You know, I was surprised to find that the state didn't have its favorite argument here, which is harmless error. So, if you're looking for the concept that this is a charge of possession of heroin in the house, right?
Right.
And this blood is a merely circumstantial evidence. You could be quite weak on that, too. You not only don't find evidence that he was upstairs, but he had left the house, hadn't he?
Sometimes. Oh, he was found in the house.
I know.
That's where he
wasn't there all the time.
He had left, but he came back.
That's right. So he could have picked up the heroin somewhere else, right?
Possibly. We don't know.
That's right. But why isn't this harmless error? Because you have all this evidence that there was heroin in the house. So why do you need this blood test? You can say, hey, they may have goofed on not suppressing it, but it's harmless error that it was available in the state. I know it's a plea case.
I'm not above making harmless error arguments.
I think that's very well stated in light of my various arguments on harmless error.
The problem is that in order to prevail on a harmless error argument, I have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it's harmless. And to go back to something I said earlier, we don't have a very good factual record in this case. In order to prove harmless error, you need a really good factual record, and we just don't have one.
I want to take a look at that factual record, because at the outset of your argument, you said the possession here is the heroin found upstairs in the bedroom. And that took me aback, because this case has not been briefed. This case has not been tried to the extent that it was tried, that is, the motion to suppress. None of that has addressed this cocaine found upstairs, heroin, thank you, found upstairs in an apartment where the defendant did not live. It was, as I understood, the brief testimony came out. It was Tanner's bedroom.
There's no indication that the defendant had ever been in Tanner's bedroom. There is nothing. At the outset, the suppression motion that was filed only dealt with the blood, taking of the blood test. The response of the state only dealt with this. I took a quick reread of your brief, and I didn't even see in it, now I may have missed it, any reference at all to locating heroin in an upstairs room of the apartment.
Yeah, there is.
I may have missed it. I reread it. If it's there, it's just a sentence or two in
passing. I'm not sure that it's in my brief.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
I'm not sure that it's in my brief. But in Parisi's brief, which has an excellent statement of facts, such as there are in this
facts,
case.
But there's no reference in your brief. There's no reference in the suppression motion and in the written response of the state to the suppression motion. What is really the possession charge is the heroin found upstairs. There's no indication at all.
That's because it's not relevant. It's not relevant to this.
And what is relevant, you think, is kind of a best evidence argument that that you seem to be advancing here under the exigency.
Right, and I certainly discussed that. I discussed that in my brief, the fact that there was heroin found in the house. I mean, I didn't go into all...
I mean, I'll take a look again for a third time, but I just don't see reference to that being found in the house at all. But, you know, we'll see later on.
I mean, that's what I argue.
Okay.
Is that
clear? Well, the criminal complaint outlines that, and that's what the charge is for.
Right.
Sure. The criminal complaint references it. It references the whole story that we know here. I'm saying this case has not been tried or argued or briefed on that component of possession. And I am saying that I have not found one word in your brief, and I'll have people look at it and check me later, that deals with the finding of the heroin in an upstairs bedroom as the basis for the charge. There's no reference at all, but you're arguing that today.
If you look at page 14 of my brief.
Okay, thank you.
I discussed that at some length.
It says a bindle of heroin was found in a room to which Parisi had access.
Right.
I mean, he theoretically had access to every room, but there's no evidence that he used that access.
Right.
But I did mention it. I didn't totally ignore it.
Thank you.
My red light is on.
Yes.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about.
Thank you, Counselor.
What the probative value differences here. And that goes on to the next paragraph in your brief on page 14. So the probative value of the evidence found in Parisi's blood depended on the extent to which it tended to circumstantially prove that he possessed the heroin found in the house. And I didn't understand the parenthetical to Paoni's case. And the presence of, then you talked about the chemical aspects of it, and you keep talking about the circumstantial evidence. It just seems that it's so circumstantial that it's not worth very much. Therefore, why isn't it harmless error?
Well, because we don't have enough facts. There wasn't enough litigation here to establish enough facts to show that they could have proved that he possessed the heroin in the house, even without the heroin in the blood, or even without the morphine in the blood, which was very helpful evidence, if not the best.
The red light is on.
Justice
Abrahamson, I'm going to ask you to delay your questions and take them up with your law clerk because he already told us harmless error wasn't argued and it wasn't briefed. You may be excused.
It's
and
not
you may
appropriate
do
to shut down.
Thank you, counsel.
We are all trying very hard, Justice Bradley, to treat both sides fairly. And counsel for Mr. Parisi limited herself to 30 minutes.
Counsel,
I don't want
time
to be unfair at all to her. Please,
well,
counsel, you
can
may
give
begin.
You a few more moments since I
may
took
begin.
Some of the time off the red
begin,
light.
We,
and
Since it is becoming a public spectacle, we have discussed this in our conference many times. This is one of those difficult situations the Chief Justice alluded to at the commencement of this hearing. So, counsel, it is your time for rebuttal.
We've discussed it, but we haven't necessarily agreed to shut down justices.
I have just a few points in rebuttal. Clearly, Mr. Parisi was not charged with what was found in the house. I agree that was never argued at any time. It wasn't the subject of the suppression hearing. It wasn't the subject of the state's brief. There's no evidence that he had access to the heroin that was found in the bedroom. He was in the living room. He was a visitor there. The bedroom was occupied by two of the roommates that lived there, found on the dresser. So there's no access that evidence that he had access. Additionally, just looking at citing Schmidt 77 with second 370, you can only have possession if the contraband was found in a place immediately accessible to the subject or in his exclusive or joint dominion. Again, this would not be that case. This is a visitor. He doesn't have access.
How do we know that, counsel? As Mr. Ballastieri alluded to, this was a plea case. He said that in response to a question from Justice Prosser. And that the whole issue about what he had access to in the house, what he didn't, in a plea case, the factual record simply would not be developed. It wouldn't be an issue at hand.
That's true that the record's not developed except for to say that he was found in the living room and that the drugs were found upstairs. He didn't live there.
Sure, but drug cases are based all the time. Many cases, as you know, are based all the time on circumstantial evidence. And whether we think it's compelling evidence, whether we think it's weighty evidence, I really don't see how that's, it's not within our ability to determine that. And I also think I'm not clear on how that is availing to you.
Well, it's true that it's not in the record, except for what I said, that he doesn't live there and it's in a bedroom. It also would seem strange.
He was a visitor, yes.
Yeah, he was a visitor. And it would also seem strange that he overdosed, yet the drugs are found in an entirely different part of the house. So there weren't drugs found around him. It would be strange for him to ingest the drugs and then, like, run back upstairs and leave the drugs there.
I almost feel like you're changing your argument now to him not entering a plea knowingly, freely, and voluntarily because he pled guilty to possession of controlled substance heroin.
No, what I'm saying is that was never, I don't believe that was ever how it was charged. I believe it was charged with the heroin that was found in his body and that the corroborating evidence was the evidence of heroin found in the house. And I would also assert that the facts of the case defeat the state's argument about needing heroin or its first metabolite. Obviously, morphine was sufficient to charge in this case, and Griffin says that you're always going to need that corroborating evidence. It can never just be the blood evidence alone. Well, that corroborating evidence is always going to explain whether the morphine found in the blood is just straight morphine or if it's a metabolite of heroin. So in this case, the other evidence was heroin. That explains that finding of the blood evidence. And you even see in the criminal complaint, it refers to morphine being found in the blood and then parentheses, a metabolite of heroin. It's commonly understood to be a metabolite of heroin. Seems that it's being charged that way all the time. But like I said, you're always going to have that corroborating evidence that explains, hey, is this heroin or is this just a straight morphine case? Additionally, on the issue of the probative value being affected, I don't believe that McNeely stands for the proposition that if you have sufficient evidence, you can forego the warrant requirements. In McNeely, they're talking about cases where you might have to act quickly because you miss that time where the blood alcohol concentration percentage changes. But here, you're not going to have that, and there's obviously sufficient evidence with the metabolite alone. As seen in this case, they use that metabolite to charge and convict him. As to the question about whether ruling for the state will result in a per se rule, it will. If the state says that we need evidence of heroin and that dissipates within 10 minutes to the first metabolite, or even that we need evidence of the first metabolite and that dissipates within an hour to 3 hours, if it takes a long time to get a warrant, if it takes 2 hours to get a warrant, there's never going to be a situation where an officer can come in and say, I'm going to have time to get a warrant. An officer is going to come in and think, I have to get the evidence of heroin. That's going to be gone in 10 minutes. I thought I heard
Mr. Ballastreri say that if it was a marijuana case, that they, meaning the state, would be done. So I don't understand your point that there would never be a case. It seemed to me he's conceding that
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. There would never be a suspected heroin case where an officer would would come in.
Thank you, and your red light is on.
Well, I have a question that I was going to ask the state. The burden of proof in a suppression motion, I think, is on the state. And if there isn't sufficient evidence in the record on the suppression motion to substantiate that motion, then it seems to me the state has to lose. And the state repeatedly stated there wasn't enough evidence presented here on the issues that the court has been asking questions.
And I would agree with that, especially if the question becomes, does this have to do with the drugs that were found in the apartment? The record doesn't indicate that he had any access to those drugs in that bedroom.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Well, I thank you both for very spirited and excellent arguments. You were a great help to all of us, as were your briefs. It's an interesting question, one that we will have to consider very carefully, as we do, of course, the cases that come before us. We are going to take a brief adjournment, so people who want to leave can leave, and then we will call our second case for the day. Thank you.